Our passage this morning is Luke 1, verses 5 to 25. When Herod was king of Judea, there was a Jewish priest named Zechariah. He was a member of the priestly order of Abijah, and his wife Elizabeth was also from the priestly line of Aaron. Zechariah and Elizabeth were righteous in God's eyes, careful to obey all of the Lord's commandments and regulations. They had no children because Elizabeth was unable to conceive, and they were both very old. One day, Zechariah was serving God in the temple, for his order was on duty that week. As was the custom of the priests, he was chosen by lot to enter the sanctuary of the Lord and burn incense. While the incense was being burned, a great crowd stood outside praying.
While Zechariah was in the sanctuary, an angel of the Lord appeared to him, standing to the right of the incense altar. Zechariah was shaken and overwhelmed with fear when he saw him. But the angel said, "Don't be afraid, Zechariah. God has heard your prayer. Your wife Elizabeth will give you a son, and you are to name him John. You will have great joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth, for he will be great in the eyes of the Lord. He must never touch wine or other alcoholic drinks. He will be filled with the Holy Spirit even before his birth, and he will turn many Israelites to the Lord their God. He will be a man with the spirit and power of Elijah. He will prepare the people for the coming of the Lord. He will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children, and he will cause those who are rebellious to accept the wisdom of the godly." Zechariah said to the angel, "How can I be sure this will happen? I'm an old man now, and my wife is also well along in years." Then the angel said, "I am Gabriel. I stand in the very presence of God. It is he who sent me to bring you this good news. But now, since you didn't believe what I said, you will be silent and unable to speak until the child is born. For my words will certainly be fulfilled at the proper time."
Meanwhile, the people were waiting for Zechariah to come out of the sanctuary, wondering why he was taking so long. When he finally did come out, he couldn't speak to them. Then they realized from his gestures and his silence that he must have seen a vision in the sanctuary. When Zechariah's week of service to the temple was over, he returned home. Soon afterward, his wife Elizabeth became pregnant and went into seclusion for 5 months. "How kind the Lord is," she exclaimed. "He has taken away my disgrace of having no children."
This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Fear. It is like a constant hum or drone that just goes on in the background of the world in which we live. Fear is kind of like static electricity that is always present, but every now and then builds up enough to give us quite a shock. Now, responses to fear vary, of course. Politicians and pundits and many in the media openly play to our fears, seeking to use fear to manipulate voters and public policy or just to get ratings and ad clicks. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you've got people who would just simply try to ignore their own fears as well as the fear that's running unchecked through our world. But we allow either response to continue to our own great peril. You see, fear is increasing. According to an annual survey done by Chapman University, in 2016, only one fear was identified by more than half of their respondents. Let me show it to you. It was the fear of corrupt government officials. It came in at 60% of people shared that fear. Well, in 2019, that same survey found the top 10 fears were now all shared by more than half of the respondents. I'll just give you the top three. They were, again, corrupt government officials at 77%, pollution of oceans, rivers, and lakes at 68%, and people I love becoming seriously ill at 66%. Let me remind you that this was all before COVID-19 and an election year. Now, earlier this month, the New York Times and Siena College Research Institute asked people how concerned they were about different things. And they found that we are very concerned about, well, for example, the next generation being worse off, losing American democracy, or now, of course, getting sick with COVID-19. See, the truth is that we are all living with fear around us in different ways. But to be clear, to experience fear, it's natural. It is normal. In fact, to be without fear would be inhuman or deeply psychotic. Fear is part of God's design for us. But what God made good can now be a source of harm in our fallen world. Part of the insidiousness of fear is that it takes many different forms. The physical, emotional, and spiritual responses under the broad umbrella of fear cover a wide spectrum. They can range from nervousness to anxiety to worry to angst, paranoia, terror, and horror. Unfortunately, many Christians are reluctant to admit they are afraid because they believe that their fears are somehow inherently sinful. And so we try to hide it or shut it down and not be honest about it. But our fearfulness does not automatically equate to sinfulness. If you are wrestling this morning with anxiety and worry and fearfulness, please do not add guilt to your cocktail of emotions. God is not afraid of our fears, nor is God anxious about our anxieties. God is not upset or mad at us when we are afraid. Instead, God knows that living in fearfulness is just not good for us. It damages us emotionally, physically, and spiritually. And God cares about that because God cares about you. And so my hope and prayer is that our Advent series, which we've aptly titled Do Not Be Afraid, will invite us to look at the role of fear and the response of God, both in the lives of individuals in the Christmas story, but also in our lives as well. And so today, we are starting with a man named Zechariah and his wife Elizabeth. If you haven't done so already, I'd ask you to get a Bible and turn to Luke chapter 1, and I'm going to read certain parts of this story for us, beginning with Luke 1, verse 5. Let's hear God's word for us. Luke writes that in the time of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah who belonged to the priestly division of Abijah. His wife Elizabeth was also a descendant of Aaron. Both of them were righteous in the sight of God, observing all the Lord's commands and decrees blamelessly. But they were childless, because Elizabeth was not able to conceive, and they were both very old. So Luke here tells us several important things about Zechariah and his wife Elizabeth. First, Luke says that they were righteous. They are blameless before God in God's sight. Now, just to be really clear, that does not mean that they are without sin or they never did anything wrong. But it does mean that they loved God and they obeyed God and they served God with all of their heart and soul and mind and strength. Second, Luke tells us that they were without children and were unlikely to have any because, well, quite frankly, their biological clocks are ticking and they're getting on in years. And of course, third, Luke wants us to know that Zechariah is a priest. It's his responsibility to work at the Jewish temple in Jerusalem, managing its upkeep, teaching the people the scriptures, and directing the worship, and much more. But at this time, there are actually about 24,000 priests living throughout the country, far too many to ever worship or to serve at the temple at one time. And so the priests were divided into 24 different divisions, each serving at the temple twice a year for a period of 1 week. And that's what Zechariah is doing now. Because Luke adds that Zechariah is there at the temple, and he has gotten chosen by lot to have a once-in-a-lifetime experience of offering incense before the Lord, something many priests never got the chance to do. But as we're going to see, it may not have just been chance that brought Zechariah deep into the Lord's presence that day. Let's pick up in verse 11. As Luke continues telling us that an angel of the Lord appeared to him, to Zechariah, standing at the right side of the altar of incense. When Zechariah saw him, he was startled and gripped with fear. But the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah." In fact, the language that Luke uses here really is a little bit more robust. He says that Zechariah is in distress. He's under duress. He's feeling emotional turbulence from the angel's appearance, and that he is in a state of terror. He is paralyzed, gripped by fear. And the angel utters those famous words, "Do not be afraid." Or as some translations have it, quite simply, "Fear not." Now, of course, this applies to the present moment, to Zechariah's response at seeing the angel there at the altar. But will you wonder with me for just a little? Is it possible that more could be going on here? See, I wonder if those words, "Do not be afraid," apply to more than just that moment. What if the angel is speaking to other fears of Zechariah? What if Zechariah walked into the temple and walked into the very presence of the Lord with a bunch of fears already? What if God has a message for Zechariah that covers his past and his future as well as his present in God's presence? See, I wonder if "do not be afraid" applies to all of Zechariah's fears, and perhaps also to ours. See, Zechariah must have surely had a fear of unending disappointment. If you were Zechariah, wouldn't you be asking, "Why me?" I mean, things are not going as planned for him and his wife. This is not the way they dreamed it up. This is not what they wanted when they were first getting married and wanting to start a family. But they've worked hard to be faithful, to live right, to always do the right things. So it's easy to think that by being good, they're somehow going to get rewarded. Have you experienced that too at some point in your life? And you feel like you've done the best that you can. You're trying to be a good person. You treat people right. You try to help out when you can. You give some money to good causes. You love God. You love your friends and your family. And yet, life is hard. You hit another setback. The money is just never enough. A relationship turns sour. Your heart gets broken. You end up in pain. And so you ask, "Why me? Why do I feel like I'm getting punished? Why don't I get rewarded for how hard I have worked for all the good things that I've done?" But here's the thing. If you think that life is fair, you will not really find support for that in the scriptures. Although Zechariah and Elizabeth are righteous and they are blameless, they are still suffering and struggling. They are still dealing with disappointment. And that leads to a fear that things will never change. Sometimes the only thing scarier than a future that is unknown is a future that is known. Zechariah and Elizabeth are only getting older. The chances of having a child of their own are draining away with each passing day. They would understandably fear that things will never get better, that they're stuck, that they would be afraid that their despondency is going to be a life sentence. And not only would they fear that it's too late for them, they're now also going to be defined by their childlessness, by their lack or absence of something good, something that others would just take for granted. And this connects to another possible fear. See, I wonder if Zechariah came to the Lord that day with a fear of shame, or even a fear of public disgrace. Even if, as he asks, why me? I would expect that Zechariah also asks, what's wrong with me? See, fear often leads us to blame ourselves inappropriately or disproportionately. And if this fear is true for Zechariah, it must be even more so for Elizabeth. In societies like ancient Israel, in which a woman's value was largely measured by her ability to bear children, to be aging without children often led to personal hardship and to public shame. For Elizabeth, a childless old age was a painful and lonely time. And so I wonder if for her, if it was years or just months after their wedding that Elizabeth began to fear infertility, to wonder what was wrong with her. And she would have heard the whispers, Elizabeth is barren. But when the rumor spreads that she is not only a flawed, second-rate woman, but also under God's judgment, did she at some point fear they were right? And could she and Zechariah even talk about it? Or was her burden born in isolation? See, this is another part of the destructive power of fear and why we need to hear God say, do not be afraid. Because fear has the power to distort reality. Fear can distort the reality about ourselves as we lose touch with our own strength and our sense of worth, and we see only cutoffs in relationships with others. Fear can distort the reality of the threat that we face as our anxious thoughts amplify our problems, and so they seem unconquerable. And fear distorts the reality of God as we diminish God with our assumptions that God lacks both the power and the desire to help us. In their really helpful book, Cry of the Soul, co-authors Dan Allender and Tremper Longman put it this way. They write, fear distorts our perception of ourselves so that we seem weaker than we really are. It distorts the size of our problems so that they seem huge and undefeatable. But perhaps most significantly, fear distorts our picture of God. God seems weak, uninvolved, or uncaring in the midst of our troubles. After all, we think, if he were strong and concerned, he would not leave us in this mess. And that leads us to another possible fear that Zechariah carries with him into the Lord's presence. See, I wonder if Zechariah had a fear of God's silence. Zechariah could be excused for asking not only why me or what's wrong with me, but also asking, where is God? Why doesn't God answer me? Zechariah's parents had given him a name that actually means the Lord remembers. That's what Zechariah means. But the Lord seems to have forgotten Zechariah and Elizabeth too, and their desire to be parents themselves. Zechariah and Elizabeth experienced great pain in waiting on God, who remains silent for such a long time. And again, we can struggle with that too. In fact, if you were to ask me, what is the single biggest motivator for your prayer life? I could answer that question in two words. The thing that motivates me most to pray is answered prayer. When I pray and God answers, when there is a need and God, in response to prayer, gives a really clear direction, or there's somebody who has been away from God for many years and people pray for that person and they come home, or I'm feeling anxious about something and for no earthly reason, God just gives me this sense of peace. It just makes me want to pray more. See, the biggest motivator for prayer in my life, and I bet in yours too, is answered prayer. And now if somebody were to ask me, what's the single biggest demotivator for prayer, I can name that tune in two words as well. Anybody want to guess? Unanswered prayer. It's that way for most of us. Somebody would love to be married, and they pray for years to meet the right person, but they never do. Or somebody wrestles with depression, and they ask God for it to lift, and it never does. Or somebody gets seriously cheated and wronged at work, and they ask God for justice to prevail, and justice does not prevail. Having deep prayers go unanswered can cripple you with fear that God doesn't hear, or worse, that God doesn't care. And so if you're experiencing fear, as perhaps Zechariah was, I cannot promise that God will send you an angel. But I can invite you to listen deeply and carefully, even this morning, in this moment, to what God might be saying to you. Because I wonder if in your life right now, with all of the fears that you are carrying, if God might still be saying to you nonetheless, do not be afraid. Do not be afraid. Let me take us back to Luke in the gospel. If you've got your Bible still, look at what happens in verse 13. Luke writes that the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah. Your prayer has been answered. Your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you are to call him John." You know, we've all had a day in life, a day in which life just pivots and it spins in a new direction and nothing is ever the same again. Zechariah is having one of those days. First, I mean, his trip into the Lord's presence takes him where few mortals have ever been. But then there's this angel, and now there's this message. Imagine the questions racing through Zechariah's mind. God has been silent for hundreds of years, and now he's speaking to me? We're having a son in our old age? My boy is going to be the promised messenger, the royal Herod before the King of Kings? And how in the world do you fix up a nursery or pick out a good school for a kid like this? And imagine the sweeping emotions that are packed into this moment. Awe and wonder mixed with fear and trembling. Excitement and honor coupled with confusion and doubt. Zechariah and Elizabeth will have a child after all. Their disgrace and their shame is going to be taken away. Why? "Your prayer has been heard," declares the angel of the Lord. Can I ask you to sit with a couple questions for a few moments? If God sent a messenger to you about what in your life right now would God say, "Do not be afraid. Fear not. Don't be afraid of that." And if the angel said to you, "Your prayer has been heard," what would that mean for you? I mean, in concrete terms, what would that look like? What is the too good to be true news that you're longing for? Is it something that you have given up on? Something that maybe you have slowed down on or just stopped praying about? I'm reminded here of something pastor and author Timothy Keller said, that God will either give us what we ask for or give us what we would have asked for if we knew everything that God knows. But even as God answers Zechariah's prayer, he is faced with a new fear. Again, Luke writes for us here in verse 18, saying that Zechariah asked the angel, "How can I be sure of this? I'm an old man. My wife is well along in years." This is probably not the first time that Zechariah has asked that question, how can I be sure? How can I know for certain? We all long for certainty, especially when it's needed, we think, to alleviate anxiety. It's a profoundly human thing to have a fear of the unknown. And so I appreciate that Luke is careful here not to dress up this story and make Zechariah some sort of mythical hero of the faith. His first reaction to the news is very human, very natural, very much like us. His first reaction is to grasp at straws. He needs a sign. He needs something that's going to help him to believe that all of this is true. And he will be given one. But it's not positive, but rather a negative, even a punishment, perhaps. We can almost see the angel kind of, I don't know how about you, but when I read this, I kind of picture the angel almost putting his hand on his hips and kind of just looking down his nose at Zechariah, almost telling him off for his presumed doubt at his word. I mean, can you just kind of hear how this might have sounded in verse 19? The angel said, "Dude, I'm Gabriel. I stand in the very presence of God. It is He who sent me to bring you this message of good news. And now, since you didn't believe what I said to you, you're going to be silent. You are not going to be able to speak until that child is born." To be honest with you, I think this in some ways shows the insufficiency, if not the bankruptcy, of looking for spiritual signs or maybe wonders. I mean, we often think that, you know, gosh, if God would only show me a sign, if God would only show up and do something miraculous, if God would, man, oh boy, if God sent me an angel and would speak to me, then I'd believe, then I'd have faith, then I would trust God. Yeah, really? See, here's the thing. Fear and doubt need not be opposites or be the enemy of faith. Fear and doubt can actually be a doorway that we pass through into deeper faith. Fear can drive you to a deeper faith in God. Fear can make you have a deeper dependency upon God. Fear might lead you to search harder and find even more of God. Or it can take away what you have and leave you mute. My prayer for myself and for each of us is that we will see the fearfulness that is arising around us and inside us, that we will see it as an invitation. The antidote to fear is not manufacturing bravery or mustering up courage from within ourselves, because many have tried this, and sooner or later it's not enough. Instead, what would it look like if we reframed our fears as invitations to entrust more and more of ourselves to God? Meeting fear with faith means a couple things. Meeting fear with faith means trusting God to bring good out of bad. Because I want to be really clear right here. It is not faith to call good something that is in fact bad. Don't just change the label. The infertility experienced by Elizabeth and Zechariah and all that accompanied it was not good. We can't just spray paint glitter on it with phrases like, well, God had a plan. Or one of my favorites, when God closes a door, God always opens a window. Or God just needed to teach them some things first. It is both insipid and insulting. The power of God's grace in our lives comes not from renaming something as good, but from God redeeming something that is bad by bringing out a greater good from it. Do you hear the difference? You see, we are invited to respond to our own fears by trusting that God will indeed bring redemption to us and bring good out of what is currently bad in our lives and in our world. For Zechariah and subsequently Elizabeth, that meant trusting a promise. Verse 14, the angel says to Zechariah that he, his son, John, will be a joy and a delight to you, and many will rejoice because of his birth. And so Zechariah and then subsequently Elizabeth had to trust that their broken dreams could be redeemed. What would it look like for you to choose today to trust the promise? What would it look like for you today to choose joy and delight, to trust that God will come in God's time? Meeting fear with faith means trusting God to bring good out of bad. And then second, meeting fear with faith means, well, as the Apostle Paul put it, the working out of our faith with fear and trembling. You see, after receiving the good news, Zechariah and Elizabeth are not passive, although Luke is not explicit. Let's move towards wrapping up by looking at verse 23. Luke writes that when Zechariah's week of service in the temple was over, he returned home. Soon afterward, his wife Elizabeth became pregnant and went into seclusion for 5 months. Okay, I'm going to make something obvious here. Zechariah and Elizabeth put their faith into action by having sex. Okay, we just have to name that. They kept trying for a child. And I don't mean to be irreverent, but can you just imagine this scene? I mean, Zechariah has been gone for a week, or probably more, on a business trip. And he returns home to his wife, but as he walks in the door, he cannot speak. And so here we are, that first night, and they're getting ready for bed, and Zechariah has that look in his eye. And she hasn't seen this look in old Zechariah for quite a while, and she's thinking, you have got to be kidding me. And then he starts with the sign language again. Can you just imagine him trying to communicate his intentions at this point? I mean, the whole scene is a little bit comical. But the point is this. Our faith has got to be active. You got to do something. We have to work out our faith, even with fear and trembling, to overcome our other fears and not let them master us. And then it apparently isn't long before Elizabeth first suspects that her body's changes are from this promise being fulfilled in her once barren womb. Whether out of modesty for herself or protection for her child, Elizabeth goes into seclusion, keeping to her house for 5 months. As a result, she also has 5 quiet months to ponder what the Lord has done for her and has promised to do through her. Any doubt about the sovereign power of God or about her own worthiness or her ability to be used by the Almighty was answered with a swift kick from her womb. What would happen to us if we took 5 months or maybe 5 days? Let's be realistic. How about just 5 minutes a day to ponder all that the Lord has done for us and what he has promised to do through us? What if we prepared for Christmas by following Elizabeth's example, by taking the time to look to the God of the impossible who looks down on us with love and concern? How might we too experience the great blessings of God as we share in God's unfolding plan of salvation? I know that you have some fears this morning, because I know that you're human. But I also know that there is a God who is ready to meet you in your fears, to drive the dark of doubt away, to fill us with joy and delight as we receive the promises that he has for us, to receive them in his time, though, as we meet our doubts and our fears with a response of faith that is a trust, a faith that is put into action as we live out our lives day after day, and a faith that leads us to ponder all that God has done and all that God is doing. I pray that God blesses you with that faith this day and in the days to come. Amen.